report. I think on top of that, we have also have Mike Beal. Mike, are you available?
Yes, hi, I'm Mike Beal, Senior Vice President of Denver International Airport.
And I believe that consists of all the airport officials on board. Did I miss anybody that's dialed in?
This is Usha Yadlagadda from Airport Internal Audit.
Thank you very much for joining us, Usha.
Sylvester Lavender, CFO for the Denver Airport.
Thank you for joining us, Sylvester.
I just want to clarify, you know, Ben Juarez is Director of Parking.
Director of Parking, thank you. Sorry about that, Ben. I gave you a promotion.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Rihanna, you want to begin the briefing?
Thank you. As described on page one of the report, the parking and transportation section oversees the parking shuttle system and has outsourced operations to ABM Parking Services. The shuttles transport travelers and airport employees between the terminal and concourses and several airport parking lots at no cost. As shown on page two, prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, the shuttle system had four routes for travelers. These routes were for the East and West economy lots and the Mount Elbert and Pikes Peak parking lots, which were closed during the pandemic. There were five routes to transport airport employees. Those routes service concourses A, B, and C, as well as air cargo and the landside parking lot. On page three, figure two depicts the annual totals for the cost of the shuttle services and the number of passengers transported. Due to the impacts of the pandemic, the cost of operating the shuttle service dropped by over $8.5 million. As described starting on page four, the parking and transportation section has assigned one employee to serve as the contract administrator to oversee the airport's contract with ABM. The contract administrator responds to customer complaints and reviews monthly invoices and required reports. The section also has a contract compliance group, which provides periodic oversight by reviewing ABM's adherence to contract requirements. The group also performs a second review of monthly invoices. As included on page five, there were several pandemic-related service changes to the shuttle system. The number of passengers served by the shuttle system fell from an average of 6.9 million prior to the pandemic to around 1.8 million during the pandemic. In response to the decrease in passenger demand, the section closed the Pikes Peak, Mount Elbert, and landside parking lots. The East Economy lot was changed from accommodating traveling passengers to being used by airport employees. Parking and Transportation discontinued the use of NextBus, which is a GPS system that displays the current locations of the shuttle buses. The section stopped assessing monetary penalties in the contract and increased ABM's hourly fee to compensate for less shuttle bus hours. As noted starting page six, three systems are primarily used to manage the shuttle contract. NextBus tracks each bus's location using GPS. The gatekeeper system tracks when shuttles would enter and exit parking lots. Route Manager is ABM's proprietary system that is used to record the number of hours each shuttle runs per day, the number of passengers transported, and the number of trips taken. ABM uses the bus information in Route Manager to bill the airport for shuttle service hours. As found on page 67, the audit scope covered the parking shuttle services contract and the process to procure these services. The audit objectives included whether the airport has adequate controls to efficiently and effectively manage its parking shuttle services contract. The audit team also evaluated whether the procurement process for the parking shuttle contract aligns with city rules and leading practices. The audit's methodology included interviewing personnel from the airport and ABM, as well as seven U.S. airports to compare shuttle bus services as discussed in Appendix B of the report. I will now turn it over to Sean to discuss finding one.
Thank you, Rihanna. In finding one from page eight of the report, we found that Denver International Airport inadequately monitors its parking shuttle services contract, and the contract lacks some key provisions. We found that the contract administrator does not adequately monitor several areas of the contract, including monetary penalties, bus driver safety, and contract fees. The contract administrator said they do not conduct any structured or documented review of six of the seven monetary penalties listed in the contract, except for courtesy and service, where penalties are assessed based on customer feedback. The contract administrator said they do not review or monitor ABM's processes to perform background checks and drug screenings on bus drivers, or ensure that drivers have all required certifications and are paid an appropriate wage. The airport also does not have a process to monitor whether ABM's vehicle maintenance and inspection practices conform to the contract requirements. Parking and Transportation Section did not review new contract fees agreed to in a 2020 contract amendment to ensure that fees were necessary and related to providing parking shuttle services. Additionally, we found the ABM contract does not have detailed requirements to limit bus drivers' shifts, nor does it require bus drivers' background checks or drug testing, which are outlined in federal, city, and airport regulations. Although we did not find any ABM drivers in violation of these regulations, Parking and Transportation cannot appropriately monitor ABM's performance in these areas and hold them accountable if they do not meet driver safety standards. Parking and Transportation Section also did not ensure ABM updated its subcontracts with language affirming compliance with the Federal Contract Work Hours and Safety Standards Act, as is required by a 2020 amendment to ABM's contract. Without the specific language included in ABM subcontracts, Parking and Transportation Management said the Federal Emergency Management Agency could deny the airport's request for COVID-19 related reimbursements. The Parking and Transportation Section's inadequate monitoring of its parking shuttle contract is because it lacks policies and procedures for contract monitoring and because management has not provided sufficient oversight of the contract monitoring function. Additionally, Parking and Transportation seldomly incorporates feedback from the airport's contract compliance group or parking service agents to improve contract monitoring practices. As a result of the Parking and Transportation Section's inadequate contract monitoring, ABM is not compliant with some areas of the contract and some of its internal processes are deficient. Specifically, ABM has not submitted documentation of its bus drivers' compliance with Americans with Disabilities Act training and does not have a formal training program documented for each job classification and new employees. Parking and Transportation staff, rather than ABM employees, are responding to customer complaints. And ABM allows its drivers to accept tips, which is prohibited by the contract. Additionally, ABM's vehicle inspection policy does not align with the company's current practices, and ABM does not have a policy or procedure to ensure its bus drivers have a passenger carrying endorsement on their commercial driver's license. Without assurance that ABM complies with all contract requirements, the Parking and Transportation Section cannot ensure ABM is providing the levels of service required by the contract. And the airport's liability could increase if drivers are not appropriately trained or if they do not maintain adequate licensing. The lack of contract monitoring has also led to further deficiencies in the airport's and ABM's processes that we discuss in further detail in Finding 2. Therefore, we make the following 7 recommendations beginning on page 17 of the report. For recommendation 1.1, Parking and Transportation should develop and document contract monitoring policies and procedures for the contract, including procedures to monitor driver training, wages, background checks, drug tests, licensing, and shift limits, as well as vehicle inspections and liquidated damages. For recommendation 1.2, Parking and Transportation should develop and document contract monitoring policies and procedures for payments made to ABM and for contract fees. In 1.3, Parking and Transportation should update the contract to include requirements for bus drivers related to background checks, shift limits, and drug and alcohol testing, as well as how the airport should monitor these requirements. The airport agreed with recommendations 1.1 through 1.3 and set an implementation date of November 1st, 2021. And in recommendation 1.4, Parking and Transportation should ensure that all subcontracts are updated to include the required provisions from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The airport disagreed with this recommendation. I will now pause to allow the airport to respond to these recommendations before reading the remaining 3 recommendations.
Steve, would you like to respond? You're on mute.
Sorry about that. Thank you all very much, and thank you for the recommendations. We absolutely agree with recommendation 1.1 in developing contract monitoring policies and procedures. We were absolutely deficient in monitoring this contract from the onset in 2017. And we have taken steps and we'll continue to take steps and be in full compliance come November 1. A recommendation 1.2, monitoring procedures and payment for contracted fees. We also agree with this. I'll tell you there were some misunderstandings, I think, and misinterpretation of the contract itself. Whereas the ABM drivers and the contract are required to hit headway times when they leave the lot every 10 minutes, as an example. And then the penalties and liquidated damages increase as the time goes on and missing those headways. There's also a stipulation that talks about customer complaints. And so the interpretation that the airport was following was the fact that in the event that we received a customer complaint and we missed the headway, that at that point we assess liquidated damages. And the fact of the matter is, if you look at the data, we found a couple of things that, you know, we've learned and that we can improve upon. First one is that as an example, with this contract in liquidated damages, missing a headway in every 10 minutes, we really, I think, should have had an opportunity back in 2017 when we started this contract to do some amendments to it to improve some of the language and some of the terms associated with this requirement. Ultimately, it doesn't do us any good for a contractor to be solely focused on on-time performance. We really need to make sure that there's a little bit of leeway in there and not leave customers stranded just by virtue of missing the headway. And so some of that stuff should have been implemented and put together back when we started this contract in 2010. And those are some of the things that we're working on as recommendations and implementation to ensure that we have success. The second part of that is that when we get into irregular operations and inclement weather, there should be some language in the contract that allows for some ability to operate safely. And it doesn't talk to that. If you just look at the pure data, it would suggest that they're not hitting the headways in a lot of those cases, but we should have the ability to back out some of those irregular operations and fog operations, as an example, that really hinder our ability to maintain on-time performance. And so those are some of the things that I think we're going to be putting in play to ensure that we do a better job of providing oversight and fix a lot of this liquidated damage related type of discussion and hold our company ABM accountable and responsible for providing a safe product, a on-time product, and a customer service friendly product. The last thing I would mention in terms of this is the fact that, I think during the audit timeframe, ABM had received, I think, 9 complaints. I may be off a little bit on that, but it was a very small number in terms of customer complaints. And those are the things that we held liquidated damages on. And in turn, they received, over 10,000 customer compliments. And so they are doing a very good job in terms of customer service, but there's a lot of areas that we absolutely can shore up. In terms of the contract provisions with shift limits and background checks, some of that stuff is covered under our badging protocols with the airport itself, but we understand it very clearly that we need to also be double checking and spot checking and making sure that ABM employees are adhering to those standards. And that also that we focus on shift limits and make sure that we incorporate that into our program going forward. On recommendation 1.4, ensuring the update of subcontracts in terms of where we're going, I'm gonna ask Harold Hensley to actually weigh in on that one. Harold, if you don't mind.
Sure, so we used a consultant to add the FEMA language to the ABM agreement. And I think it was added to other agreements here at the airport. And that our consultant based tactical assured us that even that putting the language into the contract, but the primary contract with us gave us the ability to collect any FEMA fees that we would need. So we don't believe that that language has to be added into the subcontracts, that we still have the ability to collect the fees that we need to collect by having it in the primary contract with our primary contractor. So that's why we disagree.
Any questions from the audit committee?
I have one really quickly.
Go ahead, Rudy.
Well, two really. Number one, can you briefly describe the complaints that you just mentioned since you only received 9? And secondly, Steve, in your opinion, is one individual sufficient to effectively monitor the contract?
So, Harold, if you don't mind handling question number one in terms of the types of complaints.
So the complaints that where we assessed the liquidated damages were very specifically a customer who contacted us and said, hey, I was at this shuttle stop for such and such a period of time. We didn't get a bus, and it took us however long to get onto that shuttle. And so then Brian would then take those complaints and then look at the data that we have using Next Bus when possible and the gatekeeper system when possible and see, okay, did ABM miss their 10-minute headway or the specific headway that was designated for that particular area at that particular time? And if they did, we assess the liquidated damages.
Rudy, does that answer your question?
It does answer my question. It's basically time, a timely route scheduling. The second one is, what is one individual sufficient enough to effectively monitor the contract? And I know you have the backup group to double check the invoices, et cetera, but what's your opinion on that, or at least your thoughts, please?
Well, so in terms of proper oversight of this contract, we're in the review right now to determine, what the corrective steps are in terms of structure and oversight. I would say, typically we do have one contract administrator overseeing many contracts throughout this facility, so one contract administrator per contract essentially is the way the structure is built. There obviously are deficiencies and shortfalls in our oversight. And so one of the things that we're doing on top of, looking at the structure and looking at individual performance, because we've got to be able to address both of those items. We also are implementing a review of all of our contracts as we go through this and make sure that we understand what the accountabilities are and what the recommendations have been so that we are in compliance with all of our contracts kind of going forward. There are clearly situations that we should have dialed in on and managed to a much greater extent back in 2017 and made some adjustments as we continued on. And so we need a process that allows for that and make sure that we are administering these contracts according to what's been agreed to and that we're receiving the right service levels that we should. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, in terms of approaching it from a structural point of view. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Other questions? Should we continue?
I had a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Hensley, I guess my question is relating to recommendation 1.4. Although you believe that the contract covers the subcontracts, what is the downside with updating the subcontracts, if any? It would tighten things up. And I guess my question is what's the downside of doing that?
So we don't control those agreements between ABM and their subcontractor. And we can absolutely talk to ABM about adding that language to those agreements, but they really control those agreements that are in place. And I think it would be wise of us in the future as additional subcontracts come on board to recommend to our primary contractors that they look at that language for future subcontracts.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Harold, could that be a part of the contract that you have with ABM, that subcontractors shall be in compliance with things like this?
It could be. We're looking at amending this agreement based on some of the recommendations from this particular audit, so we can look at adding that in also.
So it sounds like you agree more than you disagree to me. But...
Well, I agree that it doesn't hurt to have it in there. I also, where we really disagree is that it's not absolutely necessary for it to be there. Can't hurt to have it though.
Hey, I think that's a good reason to put it in.
Yeah. Checks and balances are important. Sean?
Understood, and we will look at getting that changed so that we include that language.
Thank you. Let's move on.
Okay. Finish out the final three recommendations for finding one. In recommendation 1.5, beginning on page 18 of the report, parking and transportation should establish and document a managerial oversight process for contract monitoring. In 1.6, parking and transportation should evaluate airport resources that can assist in monitoring the contract and incorporate information collected from these resources into its contract monitoring policies and procedures. And lastly, in 1.7, parking and transportation should receive and review ABM's operations manual and approve it when it meets the airport's needs and expectations. The airport agreed with recommendations 1.5 to 1.7 and set an implementation date of November 1st, 2021. And I'll turn it back over to the airport if they have any more responses.
Harold, would you mind talking about 1.5, 1.6, and 1.7?
Sure. So yeah, we agree with these recommendations that we really need to tighten up and have in place procedures and written procedures as to how we're monitoring this contract and how the contract administrator is working through these things. We've already begun working on these things, and we do have the operations manual from ABM in-house, and we're reviewing it now, looking to get it approved as soon as possible. So, you know, we think these are great recommendations to help us kind of tighten up how we're documenting the things that we're doing and making sure that we are getting into the details of what needs to happen with the agreement and making sure that those things are happening.
Okay, any questions from the committee? Let's continue to finding number two.
Okay, I'll turn over to Chris to present finding two.
Thanks, Sean. Finding two begins on page 19 of the report and contains three sub-findings. We found that airports and ABM parking services practices do not sufficiently ensure ABM complies with parking shuttle service contract. In sub-finding one, which also starts on page 19 of the report, we found parking and transportation failed to ensure ABM shuttles entered each lot within the intervals required by the contract. The figure on this slide and on page 20 of the report breaks down several contract requirements related to the service levels. As seen on the left-hand side of the figure, the contract specifies that shuttles must enter the west and east parking lots every 5 minutes and must enter the landside and Pikes Peak lots every 10 minutes. The right-hand side of the figure shows part of the contract's service level performance standard, which states, if ABM does not meet the required service levels 95% of the time, then the airport can assess monetary penalties for each interval longer than 10, 20, and 30 minutes. For instance, intervals greater than 10 minutes and less than 20 minutes are associated with a $50 deduction per occurrence. So we include the contract's full performance standard on page 19 of the report, which in addition to the 95% requirement also includes a clause about passenger wait times. ABM management told us they reached an understanding with the airport that the standard requires a customer to submit a complaint about a wait time before penalties can be assessed. However, this understanding was never incorporated into the contract or its associated procedures. Therefore, our testing focused on the 95% component, which aligns with the methodology found in the contract's associated procedures. Specifically, the procedures state monetary penalties should be based off the shuttle's compliance with the service level intervals, and there is no mention of passenger wait times or customer complaints. Using the airport's gatekeeper data, we tested compliance with the service levels for each day from February 1st, 2017 through March 31st, 2020. Figure 4 on this slide and on page 22 of the report shows the results of our test work. Each route we tested is found in the figure's first column. The number of days the shuttles failed to meet the service levels in 95% of the trips taken is found in the second column. As you can see, the shuttles along the west and east lots failed to meet this requirement in every day we tested. We then calculated the potential deductions for each route by multiplying the deduction amounts times the number of instances the shuttles were over the 10, 20, and 30 minute requirement. The potential deduction amounts are found on the right, far right column, and in total, there were about $14 million in potential deductions. More details on our methodology used to test compliance with service levels is found in Appendix A on page 69 of the report. Figure 5 on this slide and on page 23 of the report shows the results of our testing for just the peak periods. Airport staff told us that potential deductions should just be calculated for the peak periods designated by the contract. While this is not clearly stated by the contract's performance standard, we went ahead and followed the airport's interpretation. The peak periods are found along the top of Figure 5. For instance, the peak periods for the landside route are every day from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m., noon to 4 p.m., and 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. The remainder of the figure follows the format from the previous slide. As seen in the second column, shuttles along the west and east economy still failed to meet the 95% requirement during just these peak periods. We also calculated the deductions for the peak periods and still found about $5 million worth of potential penalties. We found these service level failures are a result of multiple issues. First, the airport did not conduct the required daily and monthly reviews of service level requirements. Instead, they followed the informal agreement to only research wait times if a customer complains. However, we found there were 286 customer complaints related to wait times during our audit period. While the airport applied penalties to 6 total customer complaints during this time, only one of these was tied directly to a complaint about wait times. Further, when airport staff research complaints about wait times, they rely on NextBus rather than Gatekeeper. Yet we found NextBus does not always hold the most complete and accurate information for the shuttle intervals. This is due to the loss of satellite connection and drivers not always logging into the system. Another reason for these issues is due to the lack of clarity between the contract and its procedures in terms of exactly when and how to test compliance and apply penalties. We highlight the areas of conflict in Table 2 on page 25 in the report and summarize each on this slide. As mentioned earlier, the airport's informal agreement to focus on complaints is not in the contract nor the procedures. Next, the contract mentions the requirement for the service levels and passenger wait times, whereas the procedures only mention the service level requirement. And lastly, the contract lists 10 minutes of the required service level, but the procedures list 5 minutes for the east and west economy lots. To address the issues we identified, we make 3 recommendations, which begin at the bottom of page 25 of the report and continue on to page 26. I'll provide an overview of recommendations 2.1 to 2.3 and then open it up for discussion. 2.1 states parking and transportation should enforce its review of the service levels as outlined by the contract standard operating procedures. The airport agreed with this recommendation and set an implementation date of November 1st, 2021. 2.2 states the airport should update the parking shuttle contract and its procedures to ensure consistency between the two. The airport agreed with this recommendation and set an implementation date of December 31st, 2021. Lastly, 2.3 states parking and transportation should develop and implement controls to ensure the system it uses to monitor service levels records complete and accurate information. The airport agreed with this recommendation as well and set an implementation date of January 14th, 2022. Now I'll open it up for discussion.
Steve, additional comments? We're happy that you agree.
Yeah, absolutely, we do agree. And again, I've talked about this a little bit already in the fact that We should have amended this contract to ensure that we're assessing liquidated damages consistently and properly throughout the course of this agreement. As a result of that, you know, we can only expect you to audit what's on the books, and you guys did an incredible job at doing that. If you go back and look at some of the data as it relates to some of these liquidated damages that were administered, or what we found as a finding, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you look at like the West Economy lot as an example, and you compare the 0 to 10 minute good standard, there were 105,000 examples, 105,588 out of 170,000. And then 53,337 were, you know, in the 10 to 20 minute kind of window. And, you know, combined, you know, 92.9% of the findings in the West Economy lot were actually under 20 minutes. And that kind of goes into the point I made earlier about the fact that we need to have an agreement and a standard of service that gives us a little bit of leeway, so we're not just focused on running on time, but we're delivering a high quality product. And so I would tell you, in looking at all of these different lots and the results of them, Pikes Peak is an example. If you combine the 0 to 10 and the 10 to 20 marks of what we've accounted for, 99.3% of the time, the ABM bus company hit within 20 minutes. And so I think it's important for us to understand that they're providing a good level of service. It can absolutely improve, and we can absolutely improve our oversight and administration and management of that service level so that we are assessing liquidated damages properly. And you know, certainly when we reach beyond a 20 minute mark, that, you know, we are accounting for that and making sure that we are assessing, you know, damages, liquidated damages. The other point of that again is that we need to have some better language in the contract that talks about irregular operations and inclement weather, so that we're not just looking at pure gatekeeper headway type of data, that we are documenting it every day and know that why we weren't able to achieve the standard, and if in fact there were you know, outstanding reasons beyond, you know, the contractor's control. The other point I would make is that we totally agree in terms of the data and making sure that we have the right controls in place for data accuracy. And that's one of the things that we're working on right now to ensure, between the gatekeeper and headway kinds of data and the next bus data, that we have a good triangulated effort at understanding what the true performance is and that we hold them accountable to it. I'm gonna turn it over to Harold for any additional comments that you may have.
Thank you, Steve. You did a great job of covering it. I think, you know, really the huge points that, you know, came home to me really is that, you know, we've got to do a better job of doing what our agreement says we should be doing. And then secondarily, do a better job of making sure that the agreement says what we need it to say in order to provide a good quality service for both the public and employees. And those are really the two huge, huge takeaways from this section that we really need to tighten up.
Any questions from the audit committee?
Well, I have one comment, and I think you'd really need to make sure these controls are in there, because having been a customer, when the bus is late, then the passenger is late, and the last thing you worry about is complaining to somebody at the airport about how the bus was late while you're, you know, running to catch your plane, so to speak. So you know, just judging from some, and I used to be on the advisory board at the airport, but just judging from some comments people have made to me recently about the airport, in some other areas, people do compare airports, and they may not say anything, but they vote with their feet and their dollars.
I would totally agree with that. You know, we're in the business of clean, safe, reliable, and on time. And, you know, we obviously have a lot of work to do to ensure that we're hitting that target. We do not need to have people voting with their feet. We need them to fly through and originate and terminate their travels at Denver International Airport. We do have an awful lot of work to do. Your point is spot on in terms of having reliable, dependable services and busing and getting to and from a parking lot is absolutely a point of frustration for many customers that we need to shore up. So thank you for your comment.
Yeah, I'd like to add to Jack's comment. You know, we all know that we have to get to the airport and allow for a lot of time. More than we used to, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I mean, it's just, that's just the way it is. But real life gets in the way. You know, we can leave the house with plenty of time and run into a traffic jam where there's an automobile accident or something like that. And a 30-minute delay, to me, starts to translate into a missed flight. And I agree with Jack. The last thing I want to do is complain about the bus service when I'm about to miss a flight. So I appreciate your comments, Steve. I think, you know, you're going in the right direction, and thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Sean, Chris, are we gonna continue here?
Yes, sir, over, and I'll turn it over to Rihanna to cover subfinding two.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. In subfinding two from page 26 of the report, we found that neither the airport nor AVM parking services effectively monitor customer complaints. As noted near the end of page 27, the audit team evaluated the shuttle system customer correspondence trackers. There were two separate trackers, one maintained by the contract administrator and one maintained by AVM. We found inaccurate and blank entries in both trackers. As of July 2017, the contract administrator was responsible for responding to customer complaints. When we requested a response to a sample of complaints, the contract administrator was only able to provide documentation for two responses to a customer. ABM is responsible for providing a resolution to customer complaints. However, ABM had only recorded a resolution for a handful of the sample of complaints. The section did not incorporate customer service review recommendations from the contract compliance group to improve the customer feedback process. Without improving customer feedback policies and procedures and implementing review recommendations, the section fails to ensure shuttle passengers are receiving appropriate levels of customer service. Additionally, customers did not always receive a response in a timely manner in accordance with the section's policies and procedures. We found that the response time definition was unclear within the policies and procedures and needed to be interpreted by the contract administrator, who is the only staff member responding to complaints. We also found that ABM does not have customer correspondence policies and procedures, though they are responsible for responding to airport shuttle system comments and compliments. Without improved monitoring of and response to customer feedback, the section cannot ensure customers' needs are being met. As written on page 30, the section does not analyze customer feedback to learn whether ABM violated contract terms. The content of complaints is not recorded within the airport's customer correspondence tracker, and complaints are not analyzed for trends. Without analyzing trends on customer feedback, the section can be unaware of potential issues and cannot be certain any changes made to its busing operations are having the intended effect. Therefore, we make the following five recommendations beginning on page 32 of the report. I will provide an overview of recommendations 2.4 through 2.8, then we'll open it up for discussion. For recommendation 2.4, Parking and Transportation should establish a process to review the contract administrator's activities, including contract monitoring of customer service. This process should be included in the section's customer correspondence policies and procedures, along with steps to ensure recommendations made by external reviews are addressed. For 2.5, Parking and Transportation should establish a process to update the customer correspondence policies and procedures to ensure they are accurate and reflective of actual practices in accordance with contract requirements. The policies and procedures should include a change log to report any revisions. For 2.6, parking and transportation should determine an acceptable time frame for responding to customer feedback and ensure a clear definition is included in both the contract and sections customer correspondence policies and procedures. For 2.7, parking and transportation should ensure that ABM develops policies and procedures for customer correspondence that align with current processes and the airport's contract. For 2.8, parking and transportation should ensure the data in the section's customer correspondence tracker is complete and accurate. The airport agreed with recommendations 2.4 through 2.8 and set an implementation date of November 1st, 2021 for these recommendations. I will now turn it over to the airport for any responses they may have.
Steve? From my perspective, a lot of these findings are absolutely we agree with and should have been in place. I can tell you that the ability for us to administer this contract and making sure that we have all these steps in play is, you know, critical. We should have lots of really strong customer response and understanding what those trends are. And we clearly just were not dialed in to the extent that we need to. The best way to address that from our perspective is that we are going to review all of our policies and procedures, what's really required, make sure that we have the structural integrity in place to deliver what the audit recommendations are, but we also focus on accountability. You know, people have got to, leadership have got to be able to provide the oversight and the cross checks and verifying the processes that were in the recommendations. Beyond that, I'm going to turn it over to Harold for any other commentary.
Yeah, we do agree. And, you know, this is really a point that we're focusing on, particularly with the customer correspondence and how we're utilizing that. And we're working really hard to make sure that we're making these changes and putting the policies and procedures together that really give us a framework to be able to look at this customer correspondence in a different way, track it in better ways, and then also ensure that ABM is doing the same from their end. So these are some great recommendations, and we appreciate the hard work that you guys put into this one.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay, let's proceed.
I'll now turn it over to Chris to present subfinding three.
Subfinding three begins on the bottom of page 33 of the report and states the parking and transportation section does not adequately monitor the cost of shuttle services. This subfinding includes issues we found with three key areas that impact how much the airport pays for shuttle services. Specifically, we evaluated the airport's review process for the annual busing plan, which contains the number of in-service bus hours ABM plans to operate each month. We also tested the accuracy of the data held in Route Manager, which ABM uses to bill the city for shuttle service hours operated. Lastly, we tested how well the airport followed its monthly invoice review process. According to the contract, the airport should ensure the in-service hours in the busing plan are not excessive or unnecessary. However, we found the airport does not include this type of analysis in its review. We determined the reason for this is that the busing plan procedures do not include steps to ensure this type of analysis is performed and documented. Next, we analyze the information ABM records in its route manager system. Each bus driver manually records the number of hours, number of trips taken, and number of passengers per trip. ABM staff then enter this information into route manager after each driver shift. We selected a sample of 2 months worth of data recorded for the Pikes Peak and Landside routes. As noted on the left-hand side of this slide, we found 15 entries contained errors for trips recorded, 70 entries contained errors for passengers recorded, and about 2,600 entries for in-service hours did not tie to the in-service hours recorded in the gatekeeper system. We also sampled 4 driver sheets to see if they matched the data entered into Route Manager. Of the 75 entries in our sample, 10 did not record a full hour of service, but were counted as a full hour in Route Manager. And 6 had different passenger counts, and 27 had different trip counts. These inaccuracies in the route manager data could potentially lead to the airport overpaying for shuttle services. The reason for these issues is the airport does not have any controls in place to ensure the data ABM submits is accurate. And lastly, we looked at the airport's monthly invoice review process. Each month, ABM submits its invoice, which lists the amount to be paid, calculated by the number of in-service hours times the busing fees outlined by the contract. In our sample of 8 monthly invoices, we found the airport paid 4 invoices in which the in-service hours exceeded the maximum amount approved on the busing plan. Additionally, the airport paid 7 invoices in which the billed hours did not match the support documentation. These differences here resulted from the airport's decision to allow ABM to round its in-service hours. In total, the differences in hours led to about $1,200 of underpayments and around $2,000 in overpayments. While the airport began disallowing this practice of rounding in January 2020, the airport's procedures still do not explicitly disallow this practice and do not include steps to ensure issues with the billed hours are corrected before payments are approved. So based on these issues, we make 3 recommendations on pages 38 through 39 of the report. The airport agreed with all 3 and set the implementation dates for November 1st, 2021. Again, I'll read through all the recommendations and then open it up for discussion. 2.9 states parking and transportation should update its budget procedures to ensure the busing plan only includes hours that meet expected passenger demand. 2.10 states parking and transportation should develop controls to ensure the data the contractor uses to bill for services are accurate. And lastly, 2.11 states the airport should update its invoice review procedures to ensure the in-service hours it pays for do not exceed the annual busing plan and that they match the support documentation. Now I'll open it up for discussion.
Steve?
Thank you again for the great work that you all have delivered here. It is absolutely our responsibility to perform fiscal and fiduciary oversight. And we clearly have to tighten up our procedures and ensure that we have a clean process in play for reconciling the data, reconciling the billing, and reconciling our expense tied to this, and that we're receiving the services that we're supposed to be providing. Beyond that, I'm going to ask Carol for any additional comment.
Yeah, I think you covered it very well, Steve. You know, the other recommendations, we just really need to dig hard into our policies and procedures and make sure that our policies and procedures match up with our agreement and our scope of work and our SOPs and all of those documents are matched up. And then we have a procedure in place to ensure that all of those things are being followed. So it's thank you for pointing these things out and give us a good opportunity to tighten these things up.
Any questions, comments from the audit committee? Okay, let's continue.
All right, I'll now turn it over to Vilma to present finding 3.
Thank you, Chris. In finding 3 from page 40 of the report, we found that the airport needs to improve procurement practices for parking shuttle services. We found 3 issues in this area. First, as described in subfinding 1 on page 40, we found that parking and transportation staff have not performed a cost-benefit analysis to determine the best method of providing shuttle services. Without one, the airport cannot know whether it is making an economical choice to continue outsourcing all aspects of these services, and it cannot make other related decisions, such as service level requirements. On page 41, we explained that airports have various options for providing parking lot transportation depending on a variety of factors, such as distance, cost, number of passengers, and desired service level and quality. An airport can choose to provide all services in-house and own or lease its buses, or it can choose to fully outsource these operations, including the procurement of buses. If an airport outsources the operations of its shuttle services, such as hiring and managing drivers and making schedules, but it still owns or leases its buses, this is referred to as a hybrid model. some other aspects of operations to consider are service intervals and age of buses. Although 2014 Airport's internal audit recommended evaluating parking shuttle operations prior to the previous contract expiration, this analysis was not performed and airport staff could not explain why it was not performed. As shown on pages 41 through 43, other airports perform such analysis and identify potential efficiency improvements and cost savings to their shuttle operations. All airports we interviewed owned their own fleet, which suggests that bus ownership may be preferred to full outsourcing and further supports the need for a cost-benefit analysis. The list of these airports can be found in Appendix B on page 70. Therefore, Recommendation 3.1 on page 44 states that parking and transportation should establish a process to periodically perform a cost-benefit analysis for its shuttle operations. The agency agreed to implement this by November of 2021. We will now open for discussion.
Steve?
Actually, I'm going to turn this over to Harold Hensley for his comment, as he has better historical oversight.
Okay, Harold?
Sure. So we agree that we do need to perform this cost-benefit analysis. There's a couple of hurdles that we need to jump through, but the auditor was able to point out that some exceptions had been made in some other cases. One of the primary hurdles that we have to jump through for the ownership of the buses is that there's some language in the city rules and regs that contractors can't drive city-owned vehicles. But so that was one of the reasons that we didn't really jump through the in 2016 and try to see, okay, what's the best way to do this. But the auditor has pointed out that an exception could potentially be received in order to allow a contractor to drive a city-owned vehicle. So we're going down that path, and we'll see where we end up with it. We'll do a nice cost-benefit analysis and see where it lands, and follow that recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Velma, you want to continue?
Thank you. Second, as described on page 44, we found that the procurement process for the shuttle services contract in 2016 did not allow sufficient time for competitive proposals. Figure 8 on page 45 provides a timeline of the airport's procurement of ABM's services, as well as ABM's procurement of the next bus system. Request for proposal was issued in May of 2016. Bus order confirmation date was August 2016, and buses had to be in operation in February of 2017. This leaves only 9 months between issuing the request for proposals and contract start date, and only 6 months from confirmation of the order until contract start date, while manufacturers required 10 to 20 months to provide the buses. Therefore, the chosen vendor would need an interim fleet. The need for an interim fleet posed significant challenges to prospective vendors. At the time, another company that bid for the contract said obtaining an interim fleet that met all city requirements, including the use of compressed natural gas vehicles, was difficult and exceedingly costly. Meanwhile, ABM already had a fleet at the airport, which ABM procured using the hourly fees the airport paid it under the 2008 contract. This put ABM at a significant competitive advantage. We describe on page 46 that as a result, only two vendors bid on this proposal. Other three vendors declined to propose, two of them citing unreasonable timelines. The city's executive order 8 requires fair, open, and competitive procurements. This is important to maintain the quality of services, minimize costs, and to set a high ethical standard promoting greater transparency. To address these concerns, we offer recommendation 3.2 on page 48. Parking and transportation should establish a process to ensure it maximizes competition in procuring parking shuttle services and that the process is fair and open. The agency agreed to implement this by November of 2021. We will now open for discussion.
Steve, any additional comments?
Actually, we'll defer to Harold on this one as well.
Harold? Thank you, Steve. So yeah, I've already put together a timeline for the procurement. This agreement has five years and two option years. And so I've already put together a timeline that will get us to a notice to proceed to the successful proposer, whoever that might be, that allows them a 12-month period to procure buses. And we're working towards that timeline now.
Okay. Thank you. Audit committee questions.
Mr. Hensley, just kind of listening to this, given the airport's very tight constraints on the kinds of buses, I would think that the airport owning its own buses and possibly looking at outsiders to operate them and to maintain them, given the lead times that the auditors have found in terms of ordering buses, et cetera, might be an interesting thing to look at when you look at the question of whether the airport should own its own buses and put out contracts for the operation and maintenance thereof. Not to mention the fact that the airport has a lower cost of capital than the contractors would in terms of investing in that equipment. That's just my observation for what it's worth.
Thank you. I appreciate that comment. And that's why I think it's really important for us to do this cost benefit analysis and do it, look at it from multiple different ways of how could this operation benefit from the city owning these buses, or is it the same allowing the contractor to provide them? There's some obvious benefits that you can see from ownership. We would have to contract out the maintenance. I've already talked with our maintenance people, and really they don't have the capacity physically and with employee wise to be able to do the maintenance, so we would have to contract that out. But that's what ABM is doing today, so that shouldn't be an issue for us either. So it'd be interesting to see how this cost benefit analysis turns out, where we end up.
Mr. Hensley, when looking at when the comparative analysis being done with other airports, is the standard or the industry standard is for to contract out to ABM, like ABM, or is it to own their own fleet of buses, or is there a particular standard that stands out right now in terms of bus ownership versus contracting out the bus fleet?
So it goes both ways. The work that the auditor's office did indicated that the ones that they checked with prefer the bus ownership. But it goes both ways within the industry. So it's really going to be an individual, what really works best for the city and county of Denver. It goes back to that cost benefit analysis to see, what really works. And, there's the potential of being able to hang on to the buses a little longer, which would be in favor of us owning the buses. I'm really interested to see how this all ends up.
But I would hate to see Denver being in, like a car rental agency, because that has a number of problems in itself. But I was just curious in terms of how the industry in general addresses that issue. Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
All right, thank you. Vilma.
And lastly, as described beginning on page 48, we found the procurement of NextBus did not align with city standards. The previous contract with ABM was signed in 2008. The last amendment to that contract was signed in 2014. We found this amendment did not align with leading practices and city rules. ABM did not procure a NextBus in an open competitive process, and the contract term between the city and ABM was extended beyond the allowed 7 years without an accurate justification. The city's executive order 8 requires that contracts not exceed 5 years and any extensions beyond the 3-year term should be justified. Pricing is built to allow vendors to recoup their investments in necessary assets during the contract term. The airport's 2008 contract with ABM was supposed to last a maximum of 7 years. This is not unusual for vehicle lease contracts and is not inappropriate. However, the airport used the 2014 amendment to extend the 2008 contract for a total of 9 years. The amendment itself provided two reasons for this extension. First, to allow the vendor to recoup its investments in vehicles and technology. This was inaccurate because the vendor was supposed to recoup the investment during the original 7-year period. The real reason was to pay for NextBus that was purchased by ABM based on this 2014 amendment itself. Thus, the airport circumvented the normal open procurement process for this technology and instead asked its vendor to purchase technology on airport's behalf. We could find no evidence that ABM used a competitive process to acquire this technology, and we found airport's business technologies were not involved in helping identify options. Further, the decisions made in 2014 resulted in the airport granting a sole source contract with NextBus in 2019 because this technology was already being used by the airport and passengers. Replacement would have required a capital investment of between $750,000 to $1.7 million and additional marketing costs. The second documented reason for this amendment was to minimize disruptions during the opening of the Westin Hotel and Airport Transit Center in 2015 and 16, respectively. We found that the real reason was not potential disruptions, but rather allowing the airport more time to assess potential demand decline for parking shuttle services. To address these concerns, we offer two recommendations starting on page 50. I will read both and then open it up for discussions. Recommendation 3.3, parking and transportation should ensure the airport's policies and procedures for contract amendments are followed and decisions related to amendments are accurately documented. The agency agreed to implement this by September of 2021. Recommendation 3.4, parking and transportation should establish and document internal controls to ensure it procures technology in an open, fair, and competitive process. The agency agreed to implement this by November of 2021. This concludes our presentation of the report, and I will now open for discussion.
Steve.
So again, we do agree with all these recommendations. We'll make sure that we follow suit. I'm gonna turn it over to Harold for any additional information or background that he has on this.
Sure. So these decisions that they're talking about now were made quite some time ago, and unfortunately were made by people who are no longer at the airport. So I can't really speak to why they made the decisions that they did at that particular point in time. What I can speak to is that we will ensure going forward that we are always following all of the City and County of Denver's procurement policies and processes and DEN's policies and procedures for procurement.
Questions from the Audit Committee?
I have a question, sure. More of curiosity than specifically related to this audit report, but are the parking areas themselves, are those outsourced, the running of that outsourced, or is that done by the city?
Harold?
Yes,
by the airport, I mean.
So we have a contract with SP Plus to manage the parking facilities. So basically they provide the cashiers, the revenue collection, all of those services. So we have an agreement with SP Plus to provide those services.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that concludes the audit.
I have one comment, if I may.
Please.
Mr. Hensley, the only thing I disagree with you on is that I don't think it was unfortunate that other people made these decisions and are no longer there. And from your reaction to everything. I'm rather pleased that that's the case.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. We're really using this as an opportunity.
So Steve, I know you've walked into a lot of activity and I think you're up to the task. I did want to make a comment that's not related to the audit report. I didn't have the opportunity to pass through the airport over this past weekend. And I know the updating the signage is a project, it's an ongoing project, but the signage that I saw, I thought was much better than what we've had for a long time. So good job, and I know there's more to do in that area.
Thank you for your comment. I appreciate it. We do have an awful lot of activity going on at the airport. We open up, you know, phase one of the Great Hall in the first week of November. And so lots of wayfinding signage changes have been made, but a lot more to follow as we have, you know, further, you know, construction and lots of changes going on throughout our total environment. But thank you for your comment. I would also just add that we can't thank you all enough for your hard work and effort. Having a good audit gives us an opportunity of kind of reestablishing a baseline and serves as a great opportunity for us for continuous improvement. And we know we have a lot of room for improvement. So again, I thank you, Mr. O'Brien, and your team. Thank you for coming out and thank you for helping us get better. Thank you.
All right, that concludes the briefing on the shuttle bus system. Why don't we take about a 5-minute break before we get into our analytics update?
Thank you.
I have it at 10:12 right now, 10:17 work.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
So I'd like to call the audit committee back to order. The next presentation we have is our audit analytics update. And I'd like to turn it over to Sam Gallagher, Robert Persichetti, and Katja Freeman to talk about the analytics that we do that help support our audit function.
Good morning, auditor and members of the committee. My name is Katja Freeman. I'm the audit director managing the analytics team. And today the team will give you its semi-annual update, showing you preliminary results of their risk analyses and outlining the audit support they provide to our audit teams. The risk analyses have been very helpful in identifying future audits, as you will see in the presentation. And the analytics team's audit support helps our audit teams to reduce field work, look at larger data sets, and employ sophisticated analytics to identify results and add to evidence needed. Right now, we're cross-training more and more of our regular auditors, if you will, in our office in those analytics to benefit from the efficiencies we gain from using these tools and approaches. And Sam will now introduce the team and get the presentation started. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Katja. So my name is Sam Gallagher. I'm the audit analytics manager, and I'm here with Robert Persichetti, our lead our audit analytics lead, and William Morales, our audit analytics senior. Just to give you a little bit of background about continuous auditing and some of the work that we do, in general, our analytics work can be broken into two categories. First are these risk-finding analytics. These consist of algorithms that we make to identify potential financial or performance-related risks. We report these findings internally, which are then used as part of the office's overall risk assessment process. The second are continuous audit analytics. This continuous audit is a powerful method which, like our risk-finding activities, we use automated connections to data and these algorithms that we've written to keep a pulse on risks and controls in the city. These analytics, these continuous audit analytics specifically, have been validated through the audit process, and we have automated them for ongoing monitoring. In some cases, we automate previous audit steps, and in other cases, some of our risk-finding analytics are then used by auditors in their field work. The additional audit work verifies the risks that we saw in the data and helps us identify if it's a true control failure or not. Once these risk-finding analytics have been through that audit process and verified, we consider them part of our continuous audit suite of data analysis. For today's agenda, we're going to cover both our risk-finding analytics and our continuous audit work, along with some of the other major accomplishments of the first half of 2021. First, Robert and William will give an update of the automated analyses that we've put together. And then next, William and I will provide an update on some of our newer risk-finding analytics. And then we're going to cover some of the audit support and training that we've done in the first half of the year, as Katja mentioned. As a brief overview of the systems that we're connected to, for both our risk-finding and our continuous audit analytics, you can see that we've connected to a broad range of data sets and are analyzing millions of records at a time. And we've developed over 30 analytics, which we run across these different data sets to identify either risk or control failures. I will now pass the presentation over to Robert to highlight some of these analytics that we've completed.
Perfect, thank you, Sam. So first I'm gonna touch on GenTax. That's the system that the city uses to monitor taxes owed to the city and county of Denver, primarily sales tax is what's gonna show up in there. When we're looking this for our analytics, we're looking at it in two ways. One, the timeliness of accepting those sales tax returns. Basically, how long does it take for us to get those into the system? That's important because we want to give that confirmation to the people who are filing the returns. But we also want to ensure that we don't leave something outstanding for long enough for some type of collection action or some type of letter to be issued to the taxpayer. Second, we're looking at write-offs. To give everybody a reminder, a write-off is when we have an amount outstanding owed to the city and we remove it from the system. So we say this taxpayer no longer owes the city either penalty, taxes, or interest. We're looking to make sure that every time we do a write-off, there's at least another set of eyes on it to make sure that that's appropriate
and to make sure that it's getting reviewed. So as I'm going to mention on the next slide here, I'm going to get into some of the details about the timeliness of returns. What we're looking at, this metric is the percent of returns that are processed within 7 days. What we can see is overall about 98% of returns are processed within this time frame. And this is better than when the 2016 audit had been in. So the overall, the metric is still doing better. What we can see in the last few months is a downward trend. We're not particularly alarmed by this trend yet, again, because that level is still above the point of the audit, but we're gonna continue to monitor this and look to see if that trend continues if we start to be processing these returns more slowly. On the next slide, I'm going to remind everybody very briefly about some work that we mentioned last time. Again, we're looking to make sure that every time we write off taxes, every time we say that somebody doesn't owe the city anymore, that there's a reviewer, and that reviewer is different than the person who requested. Last time we found there was a system write-off totaling about $170,000, with the average value being about $17. We did some additional work to verify that this was done in a fair or a systematic way, and we reviewed that criteria used to do this. The criteria that the system used to write off these taxes was driven by a formula. It was, and we found that it was consistently applied and in alignment with what the leadership in Treasury intended to do. We're going to talk a little bit more about that risk finding activity later, but for right now, I want to go to the next slide and give everyone another reminder about the last semi-annual update. We focused a lot on COVID, how those shutdowns and how that work from home really started to change the business practices and how we saw it in the data. To put actual dates on it, about May 10th is when we started to see those changes. Now we're starting to see a push to return to the office place and what the new normal might look like. There was a mayoral, the mayor directed that agencies start to implement a phased approach to come back to the office. So as we're looking at this data, we used one of the big advantages of continuous auditing, which is we can see things happening in real time. So as people are returning to the office, we can now see how that's showing up in our risk analyses and how that's showing up in the data. I'm going to talk to you about this with a couple of systems. The first one is the P card, or purchase cards. We're continuing to monitor these. And what we see is after COVID, there was a big decrease in how much we relied on P cards. Currently, what the data is showing us is that decrease has remained the same. We have not seen that tick back up. I'm going to talk about this in a couple of different ways. First, split transactions. As a reminder, a split transaction is anytime somebody swipes that card more than once in order to get around the single transaction limit. So basically, we set up a control that said, hey, you can only spend this much on a transaction to try to limit our risk. And these people are using their cards to get around it. We're happy to report that we noted those decrease in split transactions in 2021, and that decrease has remained constant. So we see fewer split transactions, and that trend is holding true. We're still seeing fewer split transactions. Now, the next thing that we're looking at is a risk of pass-through vendors. We're defining this as vendors where it's very easy to accept payment. Somebody can go up and sign up for an account and start accepting those payments right away. We don't have a lot of verification of who it is. Some examples of this would be Amazon Marketplace, Etsy, Square, Venmo. People can just accept those payments directly. Now, what we see is that P card spending has decreased overall, and the spending at pass-through vendors has also decreased, but the proportions remain about the same. So the percentage of P card transactions that are going to Amazon specifically are about the same as they were before the pandemic. Now, a percentage of a smaller number is going to be a smaller number. So this is another risk that we're going to continue to monitor in the future to see how that changes. So moving on to moving on to the next slide, we have the travel part. Travel significantly was reduced during the pandemic, and we saw that that decline was over 50%. What we're looking at travel cards for is something called the merchant category code. Every merchant has to register and say what type of business they are. We analyzed the travel card rules and grouped things into categories. So low risk are the types of merchants that appear to be allowed all the time. High risk are the merchants that, based on the rules, may not fit. They may not fit what is an allowed purchase under a travel card specifically. And then the medium risk are the types of merchants that are allowed under certain circumstances. Now on the next slide, what you'll see, last time we reported no high risk transactions. We didn't observe any of them starting in March of 2020. Travel card purchases overall remain low. We are starting to see some of those purchases in the high risk category, but overall it makes a very, very small percent of the total travel card spend. It's also less than it was prior to the COVID shutdowns. This is another one of those risks that we're going to continue to monitor into the future. So next I want to talk about a data set called supplier invoices. What we're looking at here is checks that are held for pickup. In this instance, the city is physically producing a check and we're holding it for somebody to physically take from the accounts payable team. This is a risk because it increases the risk, according to the ACFE, the risk of asset misappropriation, and it increases the risk of somebody physically just taking one of those checks. We noted that these numbers have declined and have stayed low. So agencies in general are relying on help for pickup checks less and less. However, we're still seeing the occasional fairly large held for pickup check. And you see on the next slide here what trends we're looking at here. So overall, we're seeing that decline, especially from the 2018 audit, the peak in the 2018 audit. We're seeing that decline and we're seeing that remain lower. All right. So those are the risks that we're looking at for COVID specifically. Obviously, it's going to be an element throughout the rest of the presentation because it changed so many business practices. I'm now going to hand things over to Will, and he's going to tell you about some of the other continuous audits.
Thank you, Robert. So the next group of data that I want to talk about concerns purchase orders. And our first analysis that we're conducting with purchase orders is tracking unauthorized purchases. Now, to remind everybody, an unauthorized purchase is when an agency makes a purchase and that does not follow the procurement procedures. There are three different types of unauthorized purchases that are tracked by the city. These are after-the-fact purchases. These are when an agency makes a purchase using valid pricing, but makes the purchase prior to the purchase order being issued. There are also code violations and fiscal rule violations. Now, the thing that they have in common is that both of these do not follow the procurement procedures. Code violations are for purchases that are made over $10,000. Fiscal rule violations are for those that are made under $10,000. Our analysis is showing on the next slide here, the green line and the orange line are after the fact and code violations. They've generally been decreasing throughout our analysis. We have noticed that fiscal rule violations, so those are purchases that are under $10,000, still continue to have an upward trend. So in total number, they have decreased, but we're still noticing an upward trend happening with unauthorized purchases under $10,000.
Contacts that were never assigned to an agent. We found about 868 accounts worth about $176,000 worth of penalties interest that had for a glitch in the system hadn't been assigned, and we've notified the agency of this issue. We also found, just generally speaking, that through some other research that site visits are the most effective measure of collecting taxes. The next being phone calls, and lastly, emails and notifications. And so we think that there can be some use of those strategies to improve the city's tax collection processes. So I'll pause very quickly here just to give you a chance to ask any questions or comments on these two newer projects related to either the journal entries or Gentax.
Any comments, questions?
Okay, so moving on, our team also provides a lot of audit support and training for the office. This support includes methodological support, often focused on sampling plans and survey design, and we also do a number of data analytics. For example, this year we helped out the Coronavirus Relief Fund audit, where we analyzed journal entry composition and the cost classification of those entries. And we also looked at or helped develop a sampling methodology for them to test and evaluate their results. We also looked at the data construction management audit helped them with some data analysis of cost elements and composition of financial data. We provided some mapping analysis for the parks legacy management audit to show where in the city the parks monies are being spent. And then we also worked with an IT team to develop and execute a phishing simulation. And this audit was presented earlier this year. With respect to training and outreach, we've provided training on three analytical tools: Arbutus, which is an audit software, Excel, and Tableau, which is a data visualization tool. And we've also provided training on how to develop attributes in general, which is a more of a methods training. We also were able to present at the Rocky Mountain Information Security Conference, demonstrating how to create and assess a phishing simulation to identify the types of phishing emails that an organization is most vulnerable to. And this was largely based on the results of our phishing simulation that we performed earlier in the year. In terms of next steps, our team's focus for the remainder of the year will be finishing up a full audit of the expense report review process. If you recall from our January or February update, we identified some risks with how expense reports are being classified, and our initial scope was just to quantify that issue. However, we found some risks in there that we then transitioned this to a full audit, and we'll be presenting those results in November of this year. We also will continue to develop our analytical techniques. For example, we're going to be looking at methods for identifying data quality issues within large data sets. This includes a statistical technique called a cluster analysis, which helps identify similarities within groups. And so using clustering, you can say, well, all these data points in a field look similar. And then if there's a few other clusters that don't match the other ones, that could indicate a data quality problem. So we'll be spending a little bit of time seeing if we can develop that process. And then finally, in late September, we'll present on the phishing audit and the simulations at the Rocky Mountain Area Conference for Finance, Accounting, and Auditors. Finally, we'll be continuing to cross-train auditors to expand our data capacity within the city. We're working with management and to identify individuals in the office who are interested in getting more data science training and supporting that training through some external training opportunities. And then also we'll be providing more Excel training and some training on sampling methods to the office. So this concludes our presentation of our semi-annual update, and I'd like to open the floor for any final questions or comments. Thank you.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Again. Sam, you mentioned on that last slide of next steps that the expense report auditing was focused, or at least I took it to mean it was focused on the approval of expense reports. I was curious as to back on the issue of the overlapping circles and where the risks were. What happens to that information? Do the place where the circles all converge, does someone look into those expense reports specifically, or does it go back to the agency to look at those, or
our team used that first analysis where we identified those overlapping circles, and we took those that had two or more overlapping risks, and we called that a high risk group. And I think it was February or the last mid-year update that we gave you, we did what we called a meta-analysis where we wanted to understand, are these risks actually finding risky transactions? And so we took that high-risk group and we sampled from those, and then we took a non-high-risk group, just a general random sample, and we performed attribute tests on both of those. And we did find that that high-risk group had a higher failure rate with respect to how things were documented and how expense reports were classified. And that's what spurred this deeper dive into the classification of the expense reports, which then uncovered, hey, there seems to be some issues with the approval process. So the chain of events from that first analytic was that it did find a high-risk group. And then now we're identifying the cause and effect of those high-risk groups.
So is that all going into the audit that's underway now, or did the findings of the anomalies in the expense reports themselves, did we take action on that, or what's the normal course of events after that?
We're focusing on those from the sample that were true. I guess what we could say is a true positive. So things that were actually a risk, those inform the scope of the full audit. Like any analytic, there can be very good reasons to have an even dollar, or, you know, just because the person is a top spender doesn't mean all their transactions are bad. It just means they have a position where they're buying a lot. So those initial risk finding analytics have a lot of false positives, but the sampling techniques that we used allow us to find the true positives within that category, which mm-hmm. then shifted our focus into those problem areas.
But were those two true positives then fed back to the agency or said, you know, hey, you've got an issue here, or this person needs to be trained or whatever?
That will be part of the full audit. So by transferring into a full audit allows us to dive into the cause of those problems and then identify the effects and make a recommendation. And that's where we, you know, when we talk about, oh, we have a risk finding analytic that isn't validated yet. And then we have the validated continuous audit analytics. I guess to your point, we need to have that feedback loop of understanding and the deeper dive into the analytics, into the results to see, is it a true issue or not? And then we can give recommendations to the auditor or the audit team.
Well, I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I think this whole area is fascinating and very valuable. And I'm very excited to see this sort of thing be incorporated in the audit process. Come a long way from 30 years ago, I'll tell you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Sam and his team? You know, Sam, I want to compliment you and Robert and William and Katja in particular. We have come such a long way in this. I mean, 6 years ago, this was a concept. And now we really can look for a needle in a haystack. And you can see that the impact that's having on some of the processing of Gentax information in a timely manner is up above the standard. I mean, that the impact of the audits and the way this information has fed into the audit is just terrific. So keep up the great work, and I don't know how else to compliment you on it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, general business, anything to come before the audit committee? We do have a virtual meeting scheduled for September the 16th. Hopefully the meeting after that, we can get back together in person, but we're gonna have to play it by ear. Anything for the audit committee? Well, thanks for your participation, and we'll see you next month.
Bye.
Bye.
Recordings.
How the dog stands, how the dog kind of carries its legs and its head, its tail, how the dog's hips set, and then we kind of focus in more deeply on all the different minute points on the dog. So first we look at the, she's going to lay down for me, that made it difficult. First we look at the dog's head, and so this dog was evaluated as an American Pit Bull Terrier mix, so she is a mixed breed dog.